All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is, thank you, Saturday, March 5th. Yeah. Glassjaw, I the Mighty, Silver Snakes are performing here, but I'm talking to two members from the headliners Coheed and Cambria, Josh and Travis. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah, man, it's right.
That's evidence that they're here, yes. All right, so we're right around the middle of the tour, which should be a sweet spot because you got the early, you know, the kinks worked out and you're not completely, hopefully, sick of it yet, so looking forward to that.
We're not sick of it at all. We're just, you know what? We did New York last night, yeah. And Philly's just as important as New York. We got a lot of friends and family here, but there's like the two sides of having all the friends and the family. It's like the entertaining social part of it, and then doing the show, and then the entertaining social part of it after the show. And so, you know, by tomorrow, it'll be nice to have a day off. And then the next place we're at will be energetic again.
Yeah.
Not to say we won't be energetic on stage tonight. It's just, we're trying, that's what we're doing. We're trying to get our energy back right now.
Okay.
Get ready for people.
All right, so this tour is to sort of celebrate your new album, The Color Before the Sun, in stores now. So I guess it's fair to say you'll be playing a good amount from it.
Yes. We're playing a great deal from The Color Before the Sun, but I think it's a nice mix of new and old. I mean, it's quite a long set. We're playing almost the whole record, Color Before the Sun, sans a couple tracks. But like I said, when we have so much material to choose from, any set list is tough now to keep each record represented. And Coheed's always been about trying to put together the best set list, not, oh, well, we have to represent this record. But it is nice to have at least one or two songs from each record, but that gets increasingly hard. But people seem psyched on the set list, and it changes every night. Tonight will be different from last night. Kind of a pool of tunes that we're drawing from, and not that we've never done that before, but to do that on such a big tour I think is exciting, and I think people are pretty gassed about the set list, so far so good.
All right, now diving into the album, to start Islands and the whole album itself, there was a sound of some subway cars. Was that a case of going out, getting some field recordings of the Q train going into Brooklyn, like holding up an iPhone and getting that, or was that computer magic?
No, that was Claudio. He did record it with his phone, right?
I think he went to the subway and just recorded it. I think he has a little recorder, or I don't think it was on his iPhone, but some kind of recording device, and he just...
I believe it was with a Zoom, one of those Zoom hand recorders, so...
Yeah, and the other times he's used that to get... I remember, like, in Woodstock years ago, he got, like, hitting the guardrail with a stick, and it's somewhere on the record, you know? People probably think it's, like, a keyboard, because it was like, yow! I always really liked doing that, like, kind of capturing... You know, finding, like, the musicality, like, around you just in everyday life and stuff. So, yeah, but that's real. That wasn't just, like, a sample from the computer, which I thought was cool. It was, like, a real kind of genuine feeling about it.
That's been done the last couple of years with Lawrence Arms' Metropole. They have that strewn throughout the album. And the new Silverstein has some of that, too, with some transportation.
Just transportation sounds or actual sounds?
Sounds of the city, sounds of, you know,
We did that even on second stage. We had some weird sounds.
Yep.
Even slamming doors and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah, knocking on doors.
And
Keeping Secrets opens with the walking. That's my girlfriend who probably never had walked in high heels, Stephanie. We put her on the high heels and followed her around with the microphone. I think the reason a lot of bands probably do that is because I think creative people kind of find the music around them and find inspiration in the sounds and the noises around them. You'll see us, like, if we're all sitting up here and the driver puts on the turn signal and there's a little beat, everybody kind of starts tapping along to it. It's just... Music is part in the corniness of this, but it's all around you, and I think it's interesting to kind of dig and find it in the sounds that are just around you in, like, everyday life or whatever.
That's not surprising you'd have that perspective, because I know you do a lot of the segs and the electronic elements between songs, too, at times.
I have, on this tour, there's a couple little segue transition things that I did that are original for this tour. In the past, I did a lot more. I didn't do any of that on The Color Before the Sun. I just wasn't asked to, so I didn't do it. But, we've done a lot of that. I would imagine we'll do some more of that in the future.
Sure.
I like that stuff.
Yeah, the Afterman was filled with it, from what I understand.
Yeah, some of that we made together. Some of that on The Color Before the Sun, we just kind of did stuff with the band. Yeah. Playing, like, those kind of, maybe on previous records where there would be, like, a kind of, like, a segue type thing. We just had the band play things, which I thought was also really cool. In fact, some of those, God, I wish they would turn into songs. I think some of them are so neat. We play one of them live after Spirit Kid. We kind of go into that one. It's kind of, like, Floyd-y, bluesy almost, but kind of out thing. But, yeah, we've always liked that kind of segue stuff. And setting a tone. And I think that goes back to the sounds around you and some of that stuff used to set a tone, like the beginning of The Color Before the Sun with the subway, and that very much is what the record is about. So certain, specifically that song, too.
All right, so I know the lyrics and a lack of a concept this time is more a Claudio thing, so I'll spare you that. I believe I read in an interview. Hey, come on.
Totally cash, bro.
Oh, okay.
Kevin, that's always good.
All right, so from what I read in an interview, I believe Claudio said that as he was writing the songs, they felt a little different this time around than, you know, maybe previous times before. When you were presented with the material, did you notice this is a lot poppier and brighter and a little different than what we've tackled before?
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, that element's always been a part of what Coheed and Cambria does. I think the net has been, like, so wide and, you know, I think a song's like Two is my favorite one off the Afterman. So I just thought they were kind of going more that direction, these songs. But remember when I first heard Colors, I mean, that might not be like a heavy song, but it's exceptionally dark. I mean, that's not like a bright, happy, poppy tune by any means, in my opinion. Really dark. So there was still a darkness there. But I think with each Coheed record, it's always trying to kind of carve out a new spot and go somewhere different. So I knew that. Well, this one, you know, words like poppy or... I don't think pop is a bad word, personally. But I knew that was kind of going to be the direction. And certainly when we heard the body of music, you know, it was clear that that was going to be the direction.
Now, diving into the album credits over the years, like, you know, I do. I still like the physical format. But I've noticed things like the credits have seemed to evolve over the years. The lyrics are always Claudio, and that's understood. On the early albums, it seems like the band itself was credited with the music, and over the last couple, it seems like it was more Claudio and arranged by the band. Has the songwriting evolved and changed over the years in that way?
Yeah. No, it definitely, you know, there are certain albums where it's different, you know, but it has. It's changed in certain ways at certain points. I think on this album particularly, since we're talking about The Color Before the Sun, yes, it was a lot more, you know, he had... That's why, like, even when it came to the concept side of it, he was working on songs he didn't even know would be Coheed songs. And he kind of presented it, everybody liked it, loved the songs, and then it was just like, you know, if it's going to fit in this world, then I was already writing them without that, you know? Without that world, you know, the concept being involved. So it's almost like a comfort thing to stay with it, too. You know what I mean? Beyond other reasons for his decisions, you know, like, such as feeling like he could expose himself a little more. I'm not trying to quote him, but he said that before. Like, he's more comfortable, you know, just singing about things that have to do with himself as opposed to painting a concept over it, you know, or masking it. But back to the original question, yeah, of course, you know, like, things have evolved and changed, but I mean, the next record could have us, you know, like doing it in a very old school way, or it could that Claude has a, I was about to say shitload of song, I can't say that, and I said it anyway.
A fucking shitload of songs.
Yeah, bro,
yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it could be that he has a bunch of tunes, or it could be that, you know, I mean, it's always been usually that he has a skeleton of a song, and then we work it out together with that. We all add our stuff to that, you know what I'm saying? There's been times where maybe I have a riff, and he really likes it, and he writes a song to that, and then same thing, like, you know, it becomes a song. Generally, he's writing, like, you know, every melody vocally, you know, always, so it's like, that's where the song usually comes from a lot of the time, right? You know, it's like people listen to the vocals, so...
But it could always be different. I don't think there's always... you know, when we were doing the Afterman records, the song Dark Side of Me, that wasn't a song. That was a riff Travis was just playing and turned into a song right there in the studio. And there was a bunch of things like that on that record. You know, we recorded this rec, The Color Before the Sun, really quick, and that was by design. I think we wanted to see if we could capture what it was like when it was just the four of us playing together. So we cut the record... live, I mean, just pretty much live, all playing at the same time, all getting takes at the same time, which was challenging, you know, that was different. Usually we would make a record, the process was just different, but I don't know if there is necessarily one. It seems like it's kind of whatever happens, like Trav said, usually there's like a skeleton of a song, and then we'll all add to it, and that's when it really comes to life, and a great deal can change, you know. The drums can change everything about a song. One little guitar part can change the whole feeling of a song. But who knows? The next record, you know, We could go in and Claude could have three or four songs, and Travis might be playing a riff, and that turns into, you know, like a Dark Side of the Me type thing. So I just think there is always kind of these curveballs, and there's not always one way that anything is. It seems to be, you know, historically with Coheed, pretty different. Sure. So who's to say what the future holds? Who knows?
Yeah, there was a lot of change this time around. As you said, recording it live, you probably had to get everything nailed down writing-wise and rehearsed everything before you get in the studio so you can be fairly efficient.
Sure.
But of course, you went to a new producer, a new studio, mixing and recording in 2 weeks each, I think, from what I understand. I mean, that's a lot of change at once. So,
well, you know, I think we were up for the challenge. It was, you know, we wanted to try something different. I've seen a lot of bands that are like tremendous live bands and it just doesn't work in the studio, and vice versa. Bands that are tremendous in the studio just doesn't work live. Were we good enough to go in and after all these records and all these years to do something totally different, to have the magnifying glass on us all playing at the same time? I can cut anything to just me and a click. It's just an old hat at this point. But to play with everyone having to fall into the same pocket and be right record worthy, it's really challenging. And I'm proud of us that we did it. I remember we knocked the socks off that producer. That guy's made a ton of records. And he told us, he said, "You guys are the best band I ever recorded." Which I don't mean that in a cocky way. I think we were all like, wow, we were up for this challenge. It was really exceptional. He also said he's used to bands coming in with nothing. And, well, I got this riff. And then they write it together. We came in with a whole record. We actually cut the record in the order that it is on the actual CD that you get. We did Island first,
yeah, sure.
Eraser second, Colors third, so it went, we cut it just like that. But in rehearsing, it was really fun. We spent 2 weeks in Claudio's basement, no techs, all just kind of in a circle in the middle of the basement, and that was a lot of fun. That was being in Travis's dad's basement because his dad was away when we wrote In Keeping Secrets, the song, because hey, we can go play there late, nobody's there, no adults are there, even though we were like 20,
but
we were smoking weed and writing this crazy song. I was like, man, nobody will ever probably hear this, you know, like, whatever. We were just kids.
We started playing it live before we ever recorded and evolved playing it live. Remember?
Totally, yeah, yeah.
It just turned into more and more of it, what it, you know, was actually recorded as when we played it live.
The record label's like, you got a 30-minute set. I don't know if you should play this 8-minute song that no one's ever heard, but we'd also throw in a reggae jam in the middle of Everything Evil, and at CBGB's, Equal Vision was like, guys, there's a lot of other industry people here. We don't know about the reggae jam. That night we did the best reggae jam you ever heard. That was back when we still had, like, young balls. We were, like, awesome then. Now we're a bunch of old farts. No, I'm just kidding. That's funny, though, because I forgot about the reggae jam. And Equal Vision brought it up.
Oh, they brought it up?
They were like, dude, do you guys remember at CBGB's, we were like, you guys maybe don't, because the Equal Vision would tell us not to do something. Like, they'd stand with us no matter what, but they were like, maybe tonight the reggae jam, not, it's just such a curveball. And I think they were, like, very scene-specific. They were the scene band, but no, we still did the reggae jam. We would start off like, dum, dum, ra-da-da-dum, da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-dum, da-da-dum. We were just goofing right in the middle of Everything Evil. And we did it that night. We were a bunch of motherfuckers, you know?
Yeah.
That's funny, though. I mean, I started getting all nostalgic as soon as they said the reggae jam.
Yeah, I know. Claude mentioned. Maybe that's why he mentioned it the other night.
I don't think I brought it up to him. It's funny that, like, see how things work?
Yeah,
like,
he
we're like.
It. So we just need to bring back.
Do it tonight, dude! Doom, doom.
Zappa just make up his own bass line and we just come in.
Yeah. It'd be phenomenal, yeah.
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 You
can release this right here. I mean, maybe you'll get some interest.
The beatbox version. The acapella.
The acapella reggae jam.
This is the demo. That's fine.
Cool.
All right.
Market.
All right. So you talked about, you know, different producer, but on the Target edition of the album, you had a demo version of a song called Bridge and Tunnel. Was that one that was just like, this doesn't really fit the flow, or was that something that was eventually...
That's not... I mean, I think that Josh might have had more to do with that than I... That was a song that Claudio had that he just didn't think really fit. Josh and him worked on it more. I didn't actually even work on that tune at all, because it didn't even get to that point of, like, being like, this is definitely going to be on the record. So see what you want to do, you know, or add stuff or whatever. And so, but he did drums to it and stuff.
I really knocked it out of the park, but Claude didn't really love it. I just think he was, like, on the fence about the song in general. And I think it was deemed, we kind of been down that road before, which I think I agree. I never really loved the chorus. I loved that after the chorus. There's like that really nice.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Loved that. I wanted everybody that heard it was like, we need to hear more of that. But I still think it's a good song. Really love the verse. I think there's a good song in there. But I like the way it kind of came out. It's like kind of limited release type thing. So in a way, it's kind of perfect.
Were there other tracks that didn't make it?
I'm sure in Claude's head, there was a bunch of shit that didn't make it. Oh, sure. I mean, he played me some demos, and I was like, this needs to be on the record, but he didn't listen to me. But it was more Coheed. It was, like, heavier, kind of darker, but who knows? I mean, Claudio's... All of us are always creating, but Claudio really is, like, a work ethic. Like, he is always writing. So who... I mean, right now, he could have 100 songs sitting around that we've never heard. I don't know, you know? There's just a ton of material. And he has his own filter, as anybody would, but I bet you, like... If I heard a lot of it, I'd be like, this is amazing, this is going on the record. But, you know, there might be something about it that irks him, where he's on the fence about it. So I don't know what that process is, like where it gets determined, what's going to make a record or not. But, you know, I trust Claude and his, you know, the Bridge and Tunnel thing, like it could have been on the record. It wouldn't have been my favorite song, but I think it's actually perfect the way that it kind of is out, but it's not really out. It's not part of the official record, but it's on the special. I think that's kind of perfect in a way, so... But as far as, like, material, I'm sure we've heard little things, little riffs here and there. There might be a riff we played in 2005 that might make its way back into something. Yeah. You never know.
I think Afterman was a good example of utilizing mostly everything. I think that's a good example of how much, and there's still extra things beyond that, you know, from that record. But that was, like, that all that material, you know what I mean, like, was basically, like, utilizing everything. So it's not like we... won't do that again probably and have like a mixed batch like that, and like Josh said, even utilize things that have never been used, like, you know. But yeah, Claude does have a filter with things, and sometimes things, like, I could be like, dude, I think that's amazing. Like, there were songs that we've worked on together, like one of the songs that I had riffs like just like Dark Side of Me was Away We Go, and he didn't know how he felt about that. That didn't almost make it to that record, and I'm glad it did, you know. But
I think honestly, I think Bridge and Tunnel, the kind of, I did hear this from somebody that we'd already been there with Away We Go. Like, they were kind of similar, you know?
Yeah. And Away We Go didn't even almost make Afterman.
Oh, that's funny, because that's a great tune. But sometimes it's tough, man, when you hear something 700 times and you're playing it and it's lost a bit of its luster. And sometimes you have to find that original thing. Anybody that records music knows about this. To find that thing that really turned you on about it to begin with. And sometimes that's tough when you've heard it X amount of time, you know, like a gazillion times. So it's like, it can be rough. But, everybody in Coheed is always making music and always creating, whether it's with Coheed, Davenport Cabinet, Fire Deuce, Weird Science, other things, whatever. Certain ideas that I might have on my own might make their way into a Coheed record. Tons of ideas I've had for Coheed records make their way into, like, a Weird Science or whatever, you know? So it's all just almost like a free-for-all, but when you have creative dudes, they're always creating. Those ideas kind of... you know, end up over here, end up over there, and that's just kind of the process. It's just the way it happens. There's almost, like, no rhyme or reason to it, in a way.
And you've got Spirit Kid almost didn't make the record, from what I understand, right? I mean, that was maybe the last...
I love that song.
Travis didn't love it at first. I tell you, it turned out a lot different.
He sent it, you know, like, pretty much a demo that was just guitar with like, you know, finger drums, like, from a drum machine. And Josh was in love with it, and I was like, I don't know, man. That's, you know.
I gotta tell you, the final version turned out a lot different than what I had envisioned, but I just loved that hook, and I still do. I mean, I think it turned out almost like even more 80s than I thought. I thought it should have, since it was so poppy, it should have a little edge to it, some a little more grime to it, almost sound kind of like the demo, because the demo, like, the drums were so weird and, like, quirky and, like, just... kind of shitty in a way that was awesome and just had this real character to it. I'm really proud of the finished version, but it did come out different. But that's always true. Nothing ever comes out exactly the way I envisioned it, whether in my own projects or with Coheed. It always ends up being different, and you hope that the work you put in makes it good, but it's always different. But that hook in the chorus, when I heard it, I was like, oh, that's the shit. I love that. And yeah, I think that was one of those things where Claude was kind of on the fence about it. Travis didn't love it. Remember that guitar line that Claude played on it. It was a little goofy. It wasn't like, didn't sit right a little bit, but it's just a demo because he was just quick, do it, whatever.
Yeah, he even told me, because I actually, it's one of those cases where the guitar part stuck. So like live, I'm, you know, and well, we did the album live. So that can be some of the toughest things for me to do. So if it doesn't come from me, it's like really hard to learn things sometimes.
Me too.
Which I feel like is the best practice for me too. So, but I was like trying to learn the like the one part in the chorus, and he was like, "I really don't know what I did. I just pressed record and played a thing, you know." And
yeah,
I was like,
"Better than he did on the demo." Let me tell you that.
Oh no, I don't know about that, but I'm stoked because I figured it out, and then. Like, it made sense, because sometimes those things don't make sense, you know what I mean? Like, if you just sit there and, like, you just plan, I remember, like, on the first record on Second Stage Turbine Blade, we, on June Song, where the guitar comes in and goes, ding, 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 at the end, and then everybody kicks
back in with
it, that'll never make sense what the hell happened there.
Oh, because it was such, like, a natural thing that you just do, and then we...
Now live, I'll never be able to understand what the hell.
Not exactly like me either, dude.
Well, I mean, if I took the time and actually sat and listened and went, okay, it's like really like twice that note hits, and the, you know, and
but it is such
like
a
four
weird
beats, but
feel thing. And
I never
just
feel like sitting and dissecting it. I'm just like, if it turns out like that, cool. If not, you
we
know.
We do a kind of like a more adult version of that when we play it live. Yeah, like it makes more sense. But that was just. Travis was in a pocket, and we all felt it. And it, but that's some natural. We're all natural players. Me, Travis, and Claudio are. And give Zach a lot of credit for being such a schooled player that can like kind of bop slum it with us, and then like also be this like very schooled musician. Not a lot of schooled guys can do that. I think a lot of schooled guys don't have a ton of soul. I've found in my life, there are some that do. But we're all natural players, you know. We didn't like go to college for music and things like that. So we're a feel band. It's all about the feel. And sometimes Claudio will record something that's just, in his mind, he has the feel. And it's really hard for us to like, oh wow, it's like three bars of six, and then it goes 4/4 for half a bar. I mean, I don't know how to understand music like that. I just have to feel it here. And I think that's kind of what Travis is saying. It's all about, like, feel stuff. And sometimes learning those things can be really difficult. But that's more from, I think, you know, our perspective.
Yeah.
Claude's never had to, like, learn something from us that, hey, man, this feels really good to me. You learn this. Like, that hasn't happened yet. Maybe on the next record that'll happen.
More instinctual as opposed to theory-based and all that.
Yeah, like, just kind of feel. It's a feel thing. And Claudio has a really unique... it's not like Everything Evil, but we fell right in with that. We were just like, we hadn't played together that much. That was like a new thing, but somehow we just, I mean, that's why the band worked. Like, those dudes liked the way that I played. I was a big fan of their band, Shibuti, before I was in it. But it that didn't mean it was going to work. It just worked. You know, something like Everything Evil is like a real... We just played it. There was never like, I think this should happen here. No, we just... played it. Oh, what about this part? Oh, cool. It just was really natural. I mean, there was nothing on the line. We were just a band. And I feel like in a way for The Color Before the Sun, even though Claude had like a very specific idea, you know, I wish that I got to write more on the record.
Yeah.
I still wrote probably 75-80% of the drum things, but certain things Claude would have like a very specific idea, and I had to kind of exist within those parameters. Which is fine, but I think some of that, like, rehearsing for The Color Before the Sun was, like, getting back to just being a band. And no text, no nothing, just four guys in a room. And sometimes it felt like being in your dad's basement, or even in the three house where we would rehearse. And that's, you know, that's why I love this record. It reminds me of that. And then cutting it live, I don't know if that's something we could have done back then. I'm sure, you know. I mean, Second Stage got mistakes all over it. But, again, I love that record for that. But, I mean, I love mistakes. But yeah, I think it was getting back to just being a band, being four guys in a band, playing something that spoke to you and trying to make it come to life.
Now, as far as the liner notes again, with Claudio, with his publishing, it's called The Bag Online Adventures. For you, Travis, it's Point Me at the Sky. And then for you, Josh, it's, I'm probably going to mispronounce this, Stanley Maggio? Maggio? Yeah. Where do these come from?
Point Me at the Sky is Pink Floyd bite. That's a Pink Floyd song and Pink Floyd bite. So, yeah, old school Sid, not even Sid Barrett era, like right after he left. But yeah, so that's it.
That's fine.
Stanley Maggio was just like really well thought out. Just really incredibly deep and powerful. No, I was sitting there and Blaze called and was like, "You need a publishing name," and I was like, was sitting next to my friend Joe Maggio, and I was like, Stanley Maggio.
Matt stuck.
You're fine.
Just go past, bro.
Yeah.
Okay. Ruined interview. Thanks a lot.
Now we have to start over. So,
now
well.
We have to start over.
Totally cash, bro. Did you do laundry?
Nope. Sent it out. $20.
Oh, but you got it done. Sure. Oh, that's gangster, dude. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, I always like the idea of the point of the sky, like, it's time for takeoff, you know, that's like, you know.
I mean, it's roughly the visual I got, but I had to hear it straight.
That's all it was, yeah.
Now, as far as these solo endeavors or side endeavors, I want to dive into some of that. Now, Josh, on social media, I noticed some photographic evidence of maybe work for our Weird Science. I knew you put an album out end of last year, right? And a music video for your shovel.
Put it out on Christ's birthday, son. Second coming.
Mima.
Oh, shit.
Are you working on new stuff, or was that... I don't know where I saw the pictures. Maybe Twitter. Was that for the recording of that?
Oh, I don't know what you're talking about.
He's talking about the new stuff that you are working on.
Oh, that's not Weird Science, though. But maybe it is. I don't know what it is.
That's right. I saw your Twitter handle, Weird Science, and then I was assuming it was for that, I think.
Oh, no. I'm doing, like, a rock record type thing. I've never done that before. I've got so many songs. Actually, that guy, Jay Joyce...
Yeah.
That produced The Color Before the Sun, came into, like, the kitchen area, and I was listening to a song. I didn't know he was there. So I was very guarded about these tunes. And he had heard enough of it that he was like, what is that? And I was like, oh, these are just some songs I wrote, and I was just checking it out or whatever. And he was like, man, you got to record that stuff. Whether he meant it or not, I know he did. He sat there and listened to the whole damn thing. It was very uncomfortable for me. But just, I don't know, it inspired me, really, like, motivated me to do it. And I just don't want to be 60 years old and say, I should have made my own record. Because, you know, I think any bonehead can do this, honestly. It's not, it ain't rocket science. So I figured I'd give it a shot.
It's fine.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Oh, it's dope.
Yeah.
It kind of sucks. I'm just kidding. It's not that good.
We'll be the judge of that.
Yeah. Can't wait.
So I know you've got Davenport Cabinet now, and you've got Fire Deuce. Years ago, I saw an image. I think maybe it was a picture, and I think it said English Panther or something. Was that the original?
That record's coming. Oh. English Panther's coming.
No, that's got... I changed it to Davenport
2017, Captain. English Panther's dropping. No, I'm just kidding. It was his rap name.
Yeah, I made it as a joke rap name, and then I was like, well, I had all these songs that I recorded on, like, a regular 4-track and, like, a digital 8-track, and that's, like, the first time I ever released something was on iTunes as the English Panther, and, I just as quickly wanted it to go away, you know. The English Panther just didn't fit any project, and so I kind of was like, okay, I'm gonna remove that name, and I changed it to the Davenport Cabinet, and that slowly evolved into, like, the last Davenport Cabinet record was more of, like, a band-oriented kind of thing, where I had a bunch of songs, and my cousin actually had some songs, too.
I got a good podcast question. Is this a podcast?
Not really, but...
Okay. Yeah.
When it's on his show.
Where did Davenport Cabinet come from? Like, I know what it is, but where, why, did that just, like, collection of, that, like, spoke to you? What was there a story behind that?
The story behind the Davenport Cabinet is the brothers that do the seance, and they would get locked, they were like the age of Houdini, where they would get locked up, and there'd be a bunch of instruments hanging from the ceiling, like, tied up, too, and they were just escape artists, but they would close them, and it was in the era of morons, like, you know, the mid- to late 18th century, so they would get locked up, their assistants would lock them up, and the cabinet would close, and music would, like, just go nuts, virtuoso, like violin and guitar and banjo, and then it would open back up, and they're locked back up, and the instruments are back up, and everybody's like, spirits played it, you know what I mean, spirits did this. And so upstairs in the room where I recorded, there was like a little agreeance between all our guests that it was haunted, and we would hear stuff up there, but it was the house settling. That room's not haunted. After all these years now, I can specifically, you know, pinpoint what the things were and what the house was doing. And
is that your house now?
Yeah.
Oh, shit, for real?
So that's,
I mean,
why
if
that
ever
was
a candidate for it to be haunted, it would be that house, though. It just,
I understand, and everybody thought it was.
Well, just because it's not a new house. You know, it's not, like, built in the 80s.
It was built in 1980. Everybody doesn't understand that. They used material from an old house.
Well, that material might be haunted.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe
houses aren't haunted. People are. It's not about a house. It's,
well, so people thought that the studio that I record in had. So I was like, I have my very own Davenport Cabinet. because you'd hear like the floors creak and stuff, and like the guitar would go with it, and you'd hear like a little dang on the strings, and it would be like, oh, the spirits are playing.
On the first Davenport Cabinet CD, it's actually spirits played all
they
the instruments.
They played all
right?
the instruments, everything.
So they owed money, right?
What's that?
Spirits don't have publishing though.
Oh, okay.
Okay. The money to,
don't talk about it because they could be around us. They don't
edit this out, Henry. Edit this out, Henry.
Yeah, yeah. We want a free summer.
20%.
20% for that solo. BMG.
That's hilarious.
Well, you guys have stuff to do and to get in the right mind frame for the show, but I end every interview with this one. Stuck in a desert island with one album. What is it?
God, that changes with every desert album that I've been stuck
mine.
On.
Yeah.
You already got it? Go for it, Jake.
If I, for real, Houses of the Holy. You got No Quarter. You got a lot of different flavors on Houses of the Holy. You got No Quarter. You got the Crunge, Dancing Days. So I would do Houses of the Holy. It's one of my... You know, you ask me that tomorrow, though, it'll be a different answer. But right now, I feel like if I had to pick, and right now, and this was really happening, that's the record I would take. And then, you know, in a month, I'd be like, why didn't I take this record? Why did I take 1995's Dog Food by the Dog Pound? Why didn't I take that?
Well, see, I'm the same way. And today, I would say if I was on a desert island, I would do Neil Young After the Gold Rush. But that's just how I'm feeling today. So if I got on that desert island, I was on there, I bet you in a week on that desert island, I'd be like, what? Why do I have this record? I'm so tired. Wait, how do I listen to this record? I'm on a fucking desert island with a record.
Yeah,
where's my CD player? Or my turntable? Or you just have the record? Or do you have...
Desert islands close enough to where, like, we could swim and meet halfway and switch records? Because After the Gold Rush is a good one, and then you'll have Houses of the Holy. I know you love that record.
Oh, I'd be so into that.
It might be really scary, though, listening to, like, No Quarter alone on the island.
From another desert island would have thrown Dog Pound...
Dog food. They named their record Dog Food. That's one of the best rap records. It gets no love. I love that. And there's some shitty songs on it, but there's some real bangers, too.
Because I loved, Snoop Dogg Doggy Style growing up, and we have, like, a connection on it. But Josh showed me Dog Food for the first time a couple of years ago, and I was quite blown away. So check that shit out.
I'll have to, absolutely.
Yeah,
well, thanks for the suggestions and the answers for all the questions, and...